smoke machine smoke tends to be made up of distilled water and a glycol-based solution, such as propylene glycol or glycerin, mixed in varying proportions to create different types of fog effects, such as thick, thin, long-lasting or quick, dissipating, and so on and so forth. I was just saying that down the pub, actually, the other night.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
It's back to action for Manchester City as the final international break of the season comes to an end. We're into the home stretch with eyes firmly on a top four or five finish and the challenge of a tricky away trip in the FA Cup. Pep Guardiola's side have already lost at Bournemouth this season, so nobody will be taking the Mother's Day visit to the South Coast for granted. The competition offers a real possibility of silverware at this stage, but pretty much every team in the draw will also be thinking that as well. And then there's the home tie with Leicester as the Premier League returns on Wednesday. We'll hear from Neil from the Leicester podcast Beyond the 90 about why they're struggling so much this season. Previews of those two games coming up, plus we'll hear from the former City defender Danny Granville as he tells us all about his time at Main Road, from joining Joe Royle's promotion-chasing side in 1999 to leaving Kevin Keegan's promotion-chasing side in 2001. I'm David Mooney, and joining me to sell City down the river to further their media careers this week, I've got City fan Chris Higginbottom.
Hello. I think that's a bit of a stretch. But I appreciate the media career.
Well, we'll see. And from One Football, we've got Dan Burke.
Hello. My media career couldn't possibly be furthered. I've furthered it as far as it can possibly go. So
Haven't we all?
Keegan-esque.
Keegan-esque, indeed. FA Cup fever's hitting the Blue Moon podcast this week in the good old traditional Football Manager-style headline. I basically want to hear your favourite non-obvious FA Cup goals, please. So I'm not having like Yaya Toure against Stoke or United, because everyone knows what they mean. Just an FA Cup goal that you remember really fondly, that everybody else kind of goes, oh yeah, we scored that goal. So Dan, over to you. What we start us off with?
Got to be Billy Meredith in 1904 for me. What a goal.
You're looking good for your age, you know.
I'm feeling rough for my age, yeah. So...
Yeah, yeah. Higgy, no, any that you remember fondly?
Well, I'm sure Dan's got a more legitimate one, obviously. Were you about to...
Yeah, I was going to say, is Uwe Rosler at Old Trafford in 1996? Is that non-obvious or is that too obvious? I feel like I'm contractually obliged to mention that game and the injustice of it all every time I'm on the podcast, so yeah. I wanted to get that in nice and early. But that was a great goal, wasn't it?
It was a fantastic goal, but is that sullied by what happened afterwards? Yeah,
100%.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah. I was also thinking, I had a couple more, Ian Bishop against Leeds.
What a goal, yeah.
Again,
yeah.
Probably sullied by what came afterwards, but yeah, that was a great finish.
Yeah.
And also, I was thinking Michael Ball versus Preston. I think Stephen Ireland's goal is most remembered for that game. But that strike, did he hit it off the post and then what? He hit it and then it hit the post and went in, or I can't remember now.
Well, because I was in the away end for that, because Preston was my university city. So I was like, yeah, I'm going to this. And it was because Bernardo Corradi was useless. And the ball got played into his feet and he flicked it up and turned and volleyed it and it hit the inside of the post. And we're all like, what the hell has he just done?
That was it.
How has that not gone in? Oh, it's not gone in. Then Michael Ball runs onto the follow-up and just belts it in off the same part of the post. We're like, yeah, all right, fantastic.
I knew there was another post hit before it went in. That was right, yeah.
Yeah. The best goal of that game, though, unfortunately, was Georgios Samaras's, where it was a long throw into the box and he kind of swivels and kind of tries to kick it, but like only grazes it with his studs. And then I think three defenders kind of bumble it over the line. It's just like one of those goals where you're like, there's about 10 people who could have done something about this and none of you did. Good old classic. Higgy, any classic FA Cup goals that took your fancy?
Well, probably not as good as... A collection of that. Cursory glance at the notes, Dan said. I was saying, I've not really had much time to do any prep. He's like, yeah, me neither, mate. I've barely had a chance to look at the notes. What's this
just
mastermind?
Off the dome piece, that, mate.
What? That is unbelievable recollection. But yeah, faced with that pressure, not really got much that I can add in terms of topping that, but Toure against Palace 2017. One of his trademark free kicks. It's you know, it's really not even that merit worthy. It was so standard for him. But
was that the game? Was that the game where there was no streams of it, and some City fan made himself a hero by posting it on Telescope?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He's just filming it from the away end.
Partially obscured view as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was... Maybe it was that game, I don't know. But I remember the event that was the only way to actually view it. But yeah, what a heroic act.
What a day that was, yeah.
Copyright infringement, that was. also, Kevin De Bruyne against... I don't know if it's forgotten, but I'll probably forget it in an hour, so... Kevin De Bruyne, fourth round against Cardiff. I can't remember which year because I've not written it down. But the draft includer.
Oh, free kick under the wall.
P-roller.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Where he's basically made everyone ever since pick someone to have the onerous duty of lying on the floor to stop that going in.
Yeah, great goal, actually. Because I remember thinking afterwards, like, the precision to actually do that. Like, it's incredible, because first off, you've got to know that the ball's going to jump, because if it doesn't, you look like a right chump, don't you?
Yeah.
And then, second off, to actually drill it that hard, but keep it that low, it's actually quite a difficult skill.
Well, yeah, but just the sheer innovation of it. I mean, I'd never seen that before, and I doubt it had been done before intentionally like that, certainly not on a big stage, because... You know, nobody put the draft excluder in there before that, did they? Reminds me a little bit of one of the best goals I ever saw in a Sunday League game, where we had an indirect free kick inside the box. Slight tangent here, but...
Classic Sunday League, that, though.
They had a wall.
What had happened if the keeper picked up a back pass?
Something like that, but I don't remember the incident that led to the free kick, but afterwards they had a wall and it was literally like... about a yard from the goal line. Yeah. So you've got like 10 outfield players and a keeper just like crab man trying to look behind and see which bit he might go for. And it was me and another lad stood over the ball, and he whispers in my ear like, I've got an idea here. Just let me take it. So I was like, all right, go on then. And he took a run
on a Sunday League pitch. Somebody goes, I've got an idea. That could be that's dangerous, isn't it?
Yeah, but. Anyway, the bus ended up hanging off the edge of the cliff. But, he took this run up, and for all the world, it looked like it's like a fast bowler run up. Looked like he was going to absolutely leather it, and he just did the most delicate feather-like chip. And because they thought he was going to leather it, they were anticipating that, and kind of on the K of kick, they all started to rush forward. And he just lofted, and it was like a slow motion as they all just looked at it sailing over their head, at their heads, and it just tickled in under the bar. It's fantastic, but not
indirect though.
I think I must have touched it.
Yeah, I was going to say it wouldn't have counted if nobody touched it. Sorry for being a stickler for the rules.
No, you're a stickler for detail, and that's quite correct. But it stood, so I've forgotten a detail there. It's not even an FA Cup goal. Cutting room floor, edit it out, forget it. God, you know, you try and add something and, yeah.
Right, Bournemouth. Dan City lost at Bournemouth earlier this season, so please tell me how this one's going to be different.
Kevin De Bruyne scored a goal against Bournemouth where he hit it under the wall once as well, didn't he?
So that's
a segue into that, yeah, great. I don't think it's going to be that much different. I'm hoping that the result will be better. I mean, the defeat to them earlier in the season was kind of what kick-started this whole downturn, wasn't it, really? Because I remember we'd lost to Spurs in the Carabao Cup the game before, and you thought, it's not a big deal, really. Go out of the cup, we'll be all right. And then they lost this game, and, I don't think any of us could have seen what was coming next, really. It just felt like the first bump in the road and something that we sort of bounced back from quickly. City were pretty idiot.
What a road it's been.
I know,
It's like a dirt track now, isn't it?
Yeah, City were pretty hideous that game for about 75, 80 minutes and then turned it on at the end and almost nicked a probably undeserved draw. I think, Bournemouth hit the post and could have gone 3-3 up earlier in the game and probably deserved to be. I think the scoreline flattered City on the day, but equally we could have nicked it. So it was just, one of those games where that we've seen a lot this season, I think, where they've played all right for spells of the game and pretty badly for most of them. And I even recently we've seen that with the Brighton game last time out. They played quite well in parts of it. The first half were quite good, second half were quite bad. Could have won it, could have lost it. I think it's going to be one of those games again this weekend. It's just really hard to call, to know what City's going to turn up and to know which way the result's going to go. You just hope that we'll have a little bit of an edge over Bournemouth this time. They've not been in fantastic form either, but it's not a game that you can go into with much confidence at the moment, the way things are.
Yeah, it's a weird one, isn't it, Chris? Because you kind of think in years gone by, City going away to Bournemouth. I mean, Bournemouth had never beaten City before this season, so that tells you how well City had normally done that. But if you take it as like a percentage chance, then, you know, I don't know, 90% of games you would expect City to win. There might be 8% of games where there's a draw, and then 2% where Bournemouth win. Whereas now it feels very much like it's a third split, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. There's quite a lot of these sorts of teams where they've got a lot of young, strong players, and they're kind of learning to play a certain way under a young manager with fresh ideas. And we just go toe-to-toe with them and seem to come off second best a lot of the time. And we're kind of the opposite side of that. We're not all young, fresh players. It's not really fresh ideas. It's kind of looking a bit staid and a bit tired a lot of the time. And if what we try, you know, if the methods we employ don't work, we seem to become a bit crestfallen, and the other team detects that. And it just, yeah, the vulnerability is there for all to see, and it gets in our heads and it gets in the opposition's heads. And if the stuff we try doesn't work, we don't really seem to have a plan B. And I just hope we get off to a good start. Obviously, knockout game, we need to make it a proper cup tie and get into them, and you know, get an advantage. Otherwise, it could be curtains.
Yeah, is that a difference between City of old, though? Because you think of old Guardiola teams, you probably don't want it to be a cup tie. You don't want you don't want it to be kind of everyone up and at them sort of thing, because that gives the other team impetus. Whereas at the moment, it kind of feels like if it is a bit end to end, then there's spaces for City to exploit. Whereas if it's a bit like Forest, where the other team are not moving, City don't really have any answers. So, like, it's funny you say make it a cup tie, because, like, that's the last thing Guardiola would have wanted to do in previous years. But maybe this year it's not the worst thing in the world.
Well, this is it. I mean, I don't really feel comfortable with us trying to retain possession and break teams with these little incisive passes after we've pulled them out of position, because we just don't seem capable of doing that. The players that were capable are no longer as physically and mentally kind of at it to do that, and because we've got the wingers that we have, that's kind of where we're channeling the forward play. And wingers being wingers, you need them to get off on a good footing a lot of the time, because it's one of those I mean, I've always kind of bang on about wingers, but when you're playing on the wing, it's a duel, innit, and your psychology can be affected by how you start. And if you get the better of your man early doors, you think, right, I've got him on toast here, and that could prove, you know, really good for the game going forward. Having said that,
unless you're Jeremy Doku,
I was just going to say, yeah, you can like spread him on every round of toast you've got, and still end up not
and drop
not,
all the toast on the
floor, not eating any toast. Yeah. Sans breakfast at the end of the game. So yeah, I've kind of talked myself out of what I was saying, but you get the gist. We need to. If we're going to continue playing with the wingers in the way that we are, then it needs to work early doors and then build on that, rather than some, oh, let's do possession-based attrition, because we're too vulnerable on the break and we're not really capable enough going forward to do that.
Yeah. If you drop that toast on the floor, does it land Doku side down or Doku side up?
He gets booked for diving, doesn't he, when he's actually clearly been fouled, yeah. Well, or he's had to jump over the foul to avoid injury.
You could put Savinho on one side and Doku on the other, and it would just spin just above the floor and never actually hit. The
eternal spinning toast.
Yeah.
Bournemouth, Dan, will be eyeing up the FA Cup as much as pretty much anyone else in the draw now, I think. And I wonder if that layer adds a layer of kind of trickiness to this tie. Already tricky because City are away. You know, we've already talked about the bad vibes we had from the game earlier in the season. But if they're looking at it going, this is a quarter-final, and, you know, if we can knock City out, we've got a really good chance of winning this thing, then it's a recipe for, like, a banana skin, isn't it?
It is, and we're sort of, like, the big bad wolf in the FA Cup, aren't we, that's left here now? I think everybody would sort of like to see City go out of it and someone else win it. I don't think anyone except City fans would be sort of like pleased to see City win the FA Cup this year, when probably everyone's going to be rooting for Bournemouth perhaps even more than they would be. And then, yeah, like you say,
getting ahead of ourselves here, but can you imagine Preston North End versus Manchester City at the in the semi-final stage? The furore that would cause.
That's got a very Billy Meredith feel about it, actually, doesn't it?
It does.
Playing Preston in the final, yeah. Yeah, so I think the streets won't forget Billy Meredith. I think Bournemouth will be well up for this one. I think they'll come out. They've got nothing to lose. You know, it's a really good opportunity for them to play a team that has really struggled this season and been, you know, very beatable, and they've beaten already. They sort of know the recipe to do it. I think they're a very good side. They've been very good to watch this season. I think Iraola's done a fantastic job there. And I think a nice little cup run would be the sort of crowning glory for them this year. Of, you know, they're probably not going to get in the Champions League now. They might creep into Europe, but that might be a struggle for them in the league positions, given that they've had a bit of a downturn in form recently. So this is kind of like their cup final, as it were. Not actually the cup final, it's the quarter final.
It's their cup quarter final, yeah.
But, you know, I think they'll approach it in that way, that it's the biggest game of the season for them, and that's going to be difficult for City.
Yeah. Hege, does it have an impact on the top 4/5 race? Because obviously there's Bournemouth in there. But, you know, Brighton, Forest, Villa all got their eyes on that FA Cup prize. And, I mean, like, you don't want to be disrespectful for those sides, but you kind of feel like any added distraction might be quite nice for City. They like City, it feels like are the more experienced. Well, they're certainly the more experienced, but it feels like they're the more capable of fighting on both fronts. Whereas a couple of these other teams might have to put all their eggs in one basket.
Possibly, but I wouldn't really subscribe to that, to be honest. I think in terms of momentum, as you approach the end of the season, doing well in the Cup will only G you up in terms of the league. I know there is a tiredness issue, and you referred to like squad depth and stuff in terms of being capable to cope, but I think that's negligible. I think the positives far outweigh the negatives in terms of what it gives these teams in and around the top five. If you're going well in the Cup, it's like you've got this unbeatable feeling about you and can only stand you in good stead in the league, in my opinion.
Yeah, and City's squad depth this season hasn't proved exactly great when everybody's been on the treatment table, has it? So.
No, we're quite shit, aren't we, at the moment?
I didn't want to put it in quite so many words, but Dan, you mentioned Bournemouth possibly not the same as what they were when City last went there. I had a look at their form. One win in five. That was on penalties against Wolves in the last round, so it's a draw, really. It's not. We know how stats work. It doesn't count as a win unless it's against Wolves on penalties for some reason. So, like, there is, like, we're talking, we get the doom and gloom feel around how City have been all season, but actually, going there, Bournemouth might just be just as worried about this as City are.
I'm sure they are. I mean, I'm sure every team still has fears about playing City, because we've got good players who can turn it on, you know, at a moment's notice and have a good game and, you know, win games. And what I always think about City going into games like this is that if we turn up and play well, then we'll win. You know, because we've got better players, we've got a better squad, we are the better team on paper. The game isn't played on paper, we know that. But, you know, all that considered, you sort of go in and you have to feel a little bit of confidence with that. But knowing what we've seen from City this season, they haven't shown their best selves often enough. They haven't shown themselves for full 90 minutes often enough. And, you know, lapses in concentration have caused us to lose games. Silly mistakes have caused us to lose games. And by the same token, Bournemouth have got good players who can cause us headaches. You know, I really like Justin Cliver. I really like Antoine Semenyo. He causes loads of problems in the game earlier in the season. So, you know, I think players like that are going to be difficult. That lad who's made his debut for Spain this week, I can't say his name yet. Dean, what's his face? Let's just call him that for now. he's really good. You know, they've got two good centre-backs there. You know, they've got a good team who can create problems and cause us all manner of headaches. So I think it's going to be a good game, actually. That's what you kind of feel going into a lot of these games, like the Brighton game against City the other week. It was a disappointing result for us overall, but it was a really good game. And I think we've been part of quite a few of those this season, because we've been quite shit and we've sort of brought ourselves down to the level of these kind of mid-table teams. And I think it's going to be another game like that on Saturday.
Yeah. Have you seen his career? I'm going to say Huijsen, Dean Huijsen. But his career is incredible.
Just looking at it, yeah.
Yeah, one game for Juventus, moved to Roma on loan, and now at Bournemouth. Played for the Netherlands to under-19s level, and then Spain at under-21 level. It's like he's done everything in the game already, and he's 19.
Yeah, he's very good.
He's got the eyebrows of a 90-year-old man. His full name is Dean Donny Huysen Weissmuller, which is quite a mouthful, isn't it? But yeah, Dean, what's his face?
Dean, what's his face? Yeah, we'll stick with that for now.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
Get a dollop of City nostalgia every Monday. Sign up at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Let's turn our attention to the league game as well, because City need every point they can get if they're going to get in the Champions League for next season. You'd hope that would mean three of the buggers when they play Leicester on Wednesday. Leicester's form is utterly atrocious, so let's hear what's been going wrong. I've been speaking to Neil from Beyond the 90 LCFC.
I'd love to come on here and be more positive. I think everybody that's been supporting the club for a while goes through a phase of, I've got nothing positive to say, and there's not really anything that... You don't want to go to the games. It's from the top to the bottom of the club, it's pretty much awful. And that's pretty much putting it lightly. Leicester fans are in... The players are not good enough. The manager, it looks like he's given up. The players have kind of given up. The fans have... Again, we've just seen this a couple of seasons ago where we're seeing exactly the same thing happen. But we've got to get into it. It's... We're in real big problems at the moment. And the only analogy I can see is that we're in free fall, but the problem is we can't see where we're going to stop at this moment in time.
Yeah. What's going wrong then at the minute? Because obviously came up in such impressive circumstances, and like, it just hasn't translated to this season at all. I mean, losing the manager's not ideal, but like it probably doesn't start and end there, does it?
Well, the manager is a I don't have a problem with Rude in himself, but it was kind of it's planning. So we went from, if you think about over the last, I think we've had six managers in the last 3 years. And again, that's just not a good planning. Not even clubs like Watford can sustain that for a long period of time. We went from Brendan Rodgers with one style of football to Dean Smith with a different style, to Enzo Maresca, who had a possession style, then Steve Cooper went attacking. And then we've got now Ruud van Nistelrooy, who's got, he was started to attack, and now he's gone into a defensive, like counter-attacking style. And with that, every manager that's come in has bought their own players, and they've bought their own style. And now we don't know a style of play. We don't know what the direction of the club is, and it's led to where we are now. And it's awful, really. And I know a lot of people personally that just aren't going, including myself, not watching the games, not going to games, because it's just... We've seen this happen before, and there's a lot of anger about the ownership, about the players, about just what's happening at the club at the moment, because there isn't any direction or future that we see or really believe in.
Yeah, what's the shape of the squad like? Because you say there that there's been a lot of players come in and a lot of change with the managers. Is the squad getting too big? Is that part of the problem as well?
I think that the issue is it's not necessarily that it's so. If we take it back to when Leicester City were competing for European football, even like Champions League, we had a clear identity of what the team was, and it was to buy in young players, to train them up, and to sell them on to other teams. So, again, James Maddison, you've got Yuri Tillemans, obviously Harry Maguire, Riyad Mahrez was another one we sold to you. That was the club's idea of what they were trying to achieve. And that worked. But then they decided to change systems, and with every manager that came in, they brought their own personnel with them. Obviously, when the manager leaves, the players still remain. So now we're in this weird amalgamation of we've got some Premier League players that are older, we've got some young players, we've got some injury-prone players, we've got some young and upcoming talents like Hermanson's a brilliant goalkeeper. Bilal Kanous will be one to look out for at the weekend. He's a fan favourite, really talented Moroccan international. But they don't gel. There's no kind of uniform or real guidance, and that's come from the top, to be honest. And we're just in this position where we have no identity. And when that happens, how are you supposed to move forward? And so different people are playing different formations. It's just an absolute mess, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and when you look at results recently as well, I mean, six defeats in a row, I think it is. You know, no goals for what feels like months. You know, the last win was against Spurs in the league at the end of January, but it's the only win in a sea of defeats. Is it getting disheartening at this stage?
I think there's we've talked as Leicester City fans about it's something that we like to talk about, which is grief. There's 5 stages of grief, and that's kind of where we're at the moment. So you go through denial, and then we're kind of at the acceptance stage at the moment. There's kind of the anger stage, and a lot of us are at the acceptance stage that we are going down. We've got a good enough squad to probably stay up, but they don't care, and we've not got enough effort and energy from the players. Simple passes, basics are being misplaced. Yeah, I think majority of Leicester fans go, let's prepare for the championship, because I can't see us catching the likes of Wolves, as you mentioned. We're not even... It's one thing if you are scoring and just losing out on games. I mean, the last game we played against Man United, awful. One of the most awful teams, people that have seen it for years, and they beat us 3-0, and quite comfortably. Yes, we had a couple of opportunities, but that's the strongest we've looked since, again, you mentioned about the Tottenham game in the end of January. It's just really, really poor. A lot of us are thinking we've replaced that at Southampton, well, at least they can kind of score goals. We haven't really got that. We can't defend and we can't score. And it's just a really horrible place to be.
Yeah, it's just looking at the record as well. It's 3 goals since the teams last met in the league that Leicester have scored. I mean, when you think back to that game at the King Power earlier in the season as well, City weren't that great, and in the end, we're able to just kind of bully the way to the points in the end. I think. What are your hopes between now and the end of the season? If you've accepted that you're going down, what do you want to see from the team from this point on?
I mean, at the moment, it's just show me that you care. And they have showed a little bit of it, but not enough to really care and stay up. And there's a difference between the likes of, without sounding too arrogant, I mean, you look at the Southampton squad, you're like, yeah, that squad's not good enough. You look at the Ipswich squad, and they've basically, even if this hadn't worked out, they've still got like one of the best championship squads when they go down next season ever. We've got not just this problem, and it's just full of problems. And also the EFL, because of what we did under Enzo Maresca and how we transformed the team, we actually are in FFP tools once we go back down. The EFL are chomping at the bit for us to get and make an example out of. So we can't just say we're going to moneyball it again. It's going to be a hard chance. And again, the club is in free fall. We've got people on contracts that are way too long. We've got there's a lot of disdain for the sporting director, or sorry, director of football, John Rudkin, who has been under fire once again. Pretty much since I can remember, we win the league. There's always been murmurs of him not being good enough. The owners, again, I absolutely love them, but they're just making stupid decisions that are costing the team dearly. It's not that they don't care; it's just that they're not running it properly, and it's leading to the disaster that is on the pitch. And it wasn't that long ago we were talking about Leicester being up there for, again, European football. But we look at the likes of Stoke and what happened to them, and they've got the money as a team and as owners, but they can't spend it. And I just don't want us to be that. But I think majority of fans have accepted that we're going to the Championship next season. And it's, what do we do? And let's get a solid identity in there from there onwards.
Yeah, just looking ahead to this game on Wednesday, what are you hoping for? Because City haven't been the City of previous years, and we've just talked endlessly about the problems that Leicester have got. How would you like to see Van Nistelrooy try and hurt City this week?
I'd like something. I've got very, literally at the moment, this is probably one of the most depressing times I've been a Leicester fan. I wish just some effort, and there isn't really anything that I can say. I mean, you go back to the previous game, I was in a stark contrast to, I went watching that game and thinking, Van Nistelrooy's just taken charge. I believe at that time it was like, okay, I could see what he's trying to do. I see what he's trying to build. And I think, to be honest, after he wasn't, again, another example, they sacked Steve Cooper. They went to bring in Ruud van Nistelrooy and they just didn't back him. They bought in a player for 450,000, or sorry, about a couple of million, and over amortization over is about 400,000 a year, and that's it. And so he's kind of given up, going, well, you've brought me in to this team, you've sacked a manager to bring me in, and you've not backed me, and the squad's not good enough, I can't keep them in the league. So coming back to the game, I just want to see a little bit of effort, and that's the bare minimum. But we're absolutely, there's nothing really there. A lot of us are looking at the remaining fixtures, because it's not just after this run of games, it's not just 9 points behind Wolves. There's yourself, I think we've got Newcastle, it's just going to be an awful run of game, and I just hope something happens, because there's not really much available to be proud of or excited about at the moment.
Yeah, if you are going to get anything from this game, who's going to do it? I mean, we always fear Jamie Vardy. Is he still somebody who's banging in the goals?
Well, nobody's banging in the goals. Nobody's scoring at all. So again, you mentioned that we scored two goals, and again, El Canoes with a brilliant strike against Tottenham, which feels like so many months away now. But no, I can't really see anybody really doing anything of substance, just because the basic concentration's not there. So I genuinely can't see anything, but I don't think we'll score. And it's one of those things where when I spoke to West Ham fans, that I can't be that bad. And they played us, went, Jesus, you guys are bad. and it's one of those where I think when we went down, and a lot of people, I called it from the beginning, if we keep playing like this 2 years ago, we will get relegated. And only when teams play us and watch us for the full 90 minutes, they see how bad we are. And I think, you know, David, we've been talking for a while. I've loved to be positive about this team, but there is very, very little to be positive about at the moment.
Yeah. Well, Neil, I sincerely hope it gets better, because some of the worst days in football are when you can see no hope for the future. And, you know, as a City fan of a certain age, I've been there with my team. So I genuinely mean that I hope things do improve. Obviously not so much that it is detrimental to City on Wednesday. What's your score prediction for this game? What are you going for the charity bet?
I'd say for 4-0 towards Man City, to be honest. Can't see a scoring. And at the moment, we are so open at the back.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
That was Neil from Beyond the 90, LCFC. Higgy, I always say when a team that is in such horrendous form comes to the Etihad, it always feels like Doctor City's on the horizon. But City haven't been Doctor City for quite some time now. There's the idea that there could be complacency with Guardiola as the manager, even after the season that they've had this season. You don't really entertain it anymore, do you?
Ooh, I don't know. I mean, as long as we score more goals than Vardy, then we should be all right. Is he fit?
I think he is, but he's not the Jamie Vardy that he once was.
I know he isn't, but he always does pretty well against us, doesn't he? And I bet he's been kind of saving himself for this. But yeah, I mean, looking at Leicester's form, like you say, they are atrocious. And if we don't beat Leicester, then we don't deserve to get into Europe. You know, it's these sorts of games that you need to win. I don't care how big a slice of complacency pie you're served up, you've got to be putting them away.
Yeah. Vardy, by the way, has scored 3 league goals since the start of December against West Ham, against Brighton and against Tottenham. He's scored 1 league goal this side of Christmas and 1 FA Cup goal, which was against QPR.
This is like an assist.
Yeah, he's not exactly firing, but he loves City, so there you go.
Yeah, sad.
Yeah. Dan, when it comes to creativity in this City side, we've talked a lot about kind of the problems that City have had kind of creating chances in the past. How can they maximise their options in these two games? Because you would expect it to be Doku and Savinho to carry on in the wide positions. You would expect, you know, some form of Foden, Bernardo, in the eights. It's not exactly been sparking a lot this season. So, how do you get more out of them at the moment?
It's really hard to say. I don't think Pep knows what his best 11 is at the moment, really. I think he's just trying a lot of different combinations and seeing what comes out of it. I mean, I'm on the subject of the wingers, I'm kind of like flip-flopping between who I'm most frustrated with at the moment. At the moment, it's Savinho. You know, that chance he missed against Brighton was really frustrating. Like, come on, mate. Like, you've got to score those chances. You've got to put that away. Doku, you know, his end product has been talked about endlessly, and it is not getting any better.
I find the Doku discussion interesting because it's like there's two sides of the coin, and whichever side you flip, you get the same outcome. Mm. it always seems to be Grealish versus Doku, and it's like Grealish doesn't have any end product and he's not creating any assists. And it's like, well, Doku isn't either, but it's like the way that they're getting there is entirely differently.
Yeah. I mean, I thought he was awesome against Brighton. I thought, you know, the way he was skinning his man every single time and really battling was, you know, he was driving City forward in that game, especially in the second half. And yeah, there is a lack of end product problem there. And I think, you know, it's been discussed a bit during the international break about whether City are helping him out in the best way they can, whether Haaland's making, you know, enough movement in the box, whether we're getting players coming into the box to try and get on the end of the chances. You know, often Doku is getting to the byline and having very little to aim for. So I think that's, you know, a bit of a problem that Pep has not solved. You know, I don't think Marmoush has set the world on fire yet. I think his goal against Brighton was very good, and obviously he got the hat-trick against Newcastle. I've not seen Yeah, I've not seen a great deal from him otherwise. I think his decision-making is quite poor sometimes. I don't think he's quite found the right link-up with the players around him. But I would still like to see him playing. I'd still like to see him starting. So it's, you know, the sort of question is, do you sacrifice one of the wide men to put Marmoush in and maybe have him coming in off the flank and then put someone else in the middle? But then who is that player in the middle? Foden isn't really doing it, is he? You know, he's been very hot and cold this season. A lot more cold than hot. De Bruyne came on for the last couple of minutes against Brighton, has played quite well for Belgium during the international break, but perhaps that shows you the sort of level of international football these days, that De Bruyne could still do it on that stage. But when he's playing in the Premier League, he just looks completely washed, really. You know, Gundogan, Bernardo, either of those, really. Neither, probably.
Yeah. I would agree.
Yeah. So it's a bit of a conundrum, and you'd like to think the players, you know, you just put a combination of that sort of front four together and they'll work it out themselves, but that's not really been happening this season. So I don't have a great deal of confidence in any of them at the moment, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, Foden, let's talk about him, Higgy, because he didn't have an especially good international break. It's pretty much in keeping with the season that he's had so far. Thomas Tuchel said he appreciates the hard work, but that he's probably not finding the right momentum. What do you make of his role in the team at the moment? Because I look at where he's excelled in the past, and I wonder if playing him wide on the right or wide on the left might help him at the moment, because it kind of gets back to that muscle memory. The only problem you've got there is who the hell do you play in the middle if you do that?
Yeah, I mean, it is a conundrum with Foden. I think, you know, it's been documented in the press that he's got a physical issue and perhaps a psychological issue as well. He looks a shadow of himself, and I was watching, just looking back at some goals, trying to pick some out for the other questions, and just watching some of Phil playing against United in that 6-3 when him and Haaland got a hat-trick, and he just looks a different human. Just looks physically more imposing, more, you know, he looks built. I mean, he's never going to be, you know, a proper unit, and that's fine because he's a slight frame, but he just looks more physically imposing, and just the way he carries himself and goes about himself. Yeah, there's clearly some issues there, and I don't think the way to solve it is to completely take him out of the spotlight, because then it's like you're being dropped, and what do you do with yourself as a footballer? He kind of, you know, he obviously lives for football. I just think you have to treat him with kid gloves, give him all the support he needs, and help him play through it. Whether taking him out of the spotlight to an extent, like you say, putting him on the wing will help, I don't know. Doesn't seem to help when he has that role with England, although he seems to be playing a bit more centrally with England. And I don't know, it's an annoying one with the national team because, well, they're just annoying, aren't they? There's a lot of annoying players. They don't really. They
and
don't
an annoying
really,
coach now as well, actually.
Well, yeah, but I mean, they don't. It's like they're actively looking not to give him the ball sometimes. I know you're biased because you're watching your team's player.
This is Sean Wright Phillips all over again, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. There's some runs he's making, and you're like, you've got to give him the ball there. I mean, you know, you make that run, you think you're in the right place, you know you are, you don't get the ball, you stop making the run, do you know what I mean? It's like, you could see his shoulders would go down, his hands would go up, his head goes down, and next time you're not going to be as positive in making that run because you know that they're not going to give it you. He's apparently been disgruntled about being moved out of his favoured position for England in the Euros for Bellingham when he'd won Player of the Year, and it's all understandable. I'm not suggesting that's the only route of the current malaise. I mean, probably loads of, you know, multiple factors, cumulative effects of getting where he is now. I don't know the answer, but yeah, I think maybe giving him a less central role will help him kind of flourish. As for, I know you said moved on from Doku and Savinho. I just wanted to add a bit about Doku and Savinho. You were saying, Dan, that the Brighton game, you thought he played really well. He kind of did keep skinning his man, but it's that game where I lost my kind of rag and my patience with him. It's almost because he beats his man so easily that he is such a frustrating figure. And it's like, how can you be so good at one thing and so incapable of finding a man after you've done that? I mean, it's just absolutely infuriating. I've defended him to the hilt so many times, and like, I just got to the stage where, do you know what? I can't defend this anymore.
Do you think it would be better, both of them, if they were played on the stronger sides? Doku played on the right and Savinho on the left, so that at least when they're getting past the man, they're on the stronger foot then and can pick a better pass. I think part of it is the sort of slowing things down by getting it onto the stronger foot sometimes.
Yeah, it worked well with an extra thought or an extra touch.
Yeah, it worked well with Savinho earlier in the season when he had him on the left-hand side. You know, was it West Ham when he set up Haaland with that amazing cross? But
yeah,
then he's gone back to the other inverted wingers. I don't think it's really working.
Yeah, maybe it's all just part of a master plan to, you know, spring that upon the rest of the teams we've played till the end of the season. Yeah, well, hopefully Bournemouth. But yeah, if it works, destroy Leicester with it. Yeah, I'd be absolutely an advocate of that. It can't be any worse than the current ineffectiveness that seems to come of all this positive wing play, in inverted commas.
Yeah, and we will look to see how that works against Bournemouth and Leicester. It's time for the charity bet. We're on £1,225 for the season so far. That money is going to the Man City Fans Food Bank Support Group. We've got 3 £10 correct score singles from William Hill on City's games. Going to try and add to that now with the next 2 matches. We're going to start with Bournemouth. I have gone for a 1-1 draw in this one because we're going after 90 minutes. So whatever happens in extra time, penalties, doesn't matter. 1-1 at full time. That's 7-1 and £70. Dan, what are you having for this?
I've gone for a 2-1 win for City.
2-1 City's 15-2, £75 if you're right. Higgy, over to you.
I've gone for 2-2 after 90 minutes.
You specifically said 3-2 City after extra time, but I was did. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Don't take extra time into account, mate. So,
no,
sorry,
fair enough.
Yeah.
Bill Hill makes the rules on that one, I guess.
Yeah, 9-1, £90 if you're right. That brings us to Leicester. We've heard already that Neil's gone for a 4-0 City win. Not feeling particularly confident. 9-1 if he's right, £90. Dan, what are you having?
I'll go 3-0 City.
3-0. The bookies are keeping everything very tight on this one. 13-2 and £65 if it's a 3-0 win. Higgy, what are you having?
3-1, I did think 3-0, and I thought Jamie Vardy will inevitably just get a little
still score.
Cheeky one, yeah.
Yeah. 9-1 and £90 if you are right. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for information on how to gamble responsibly, take a look at begambleaware.org.
You're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast. You've made it this far, so don't give up now.
Now then, after promotion in 1999, City manager Joe Royle set about building his squad further for another promotion push in an attempt to get City back into the Premier League. One of those coming in that summer was defender Danny Granville. He spent 3 years at City as the club went up into the top flight, but also suffered relegation in their first season back there. I've been speaking to him about his time at Main Road.
I started off a three-month loan. Yeah, so I got the phone call off Joe Royle. There was interest at the time. I remember David O'Leary was saying about Leicester. but he didn't actually mention about City, and I just out of the blue, I had a phone call off Joe, and obviously took it, and that was it really. I went down there, and just loved it as soon as I walked in the door.
Yeah. What was it like at Main Road at that time? Because obviously City had just been promoted. They were a newly promoted team in Division One, and obviously you're dropping down from the Premier League to kind of come there. What was the mood like around the place?
Yeah, do you know what? Because obviously prior to that, the season before, they obviously got promoted, so there was a good feel, you know, about the place anyway. And yeah, I just loved it. I remember having went there sort of pre-season. We played Liverpool, beat Liverpool at Main Road 1-0. Remember that? And they had like Gerrard playing, and you know, had a good team out. And it was just like, the thing with that team was there was a great camaraderie. You know, there was no egos. Everyone was down to earth. And as soon as I walked in the door, because you know, bear in mind, I played in the lower leagues as well, and you know, so dropping down, I just wanted to play football. And as soon as I spoke to Joe, you know, he's got so much respect for the man. And Willie, I mean, he had some great staff when you think about it, the staff he had. And it was just a real good feel about the place, yeah.
Yeah, when you got there and kind of at the opening day of the season against Wolves, you're walking out at Main Road. Had you played at Main Road before? Had you played as an away player?
No, I hadn't. Obviously, I played for the pre-season, and just like the atmosphere was... You know, I remember playing Liverpool. It was amazing. It was special about Main Road. You know, it was especially midweek games, night games. You know, I've never witnessed nothing like it. You know, it was just a real special atmosphere under the floodlights. But no, I mean, that first game of the season, Wolves. Do you know what? I was actually, I had a real good pre-season, felt fit as a fiddle. And then I actually watched a couple of years back, I watched the game and couldn't believe the intensity of it and the atmosphere. It was like, it was fantastic. And I think it was Robbie Keane nicked it, wasn't it? They won 1-0. But it was a fantastic game. And I was gutted because a ball over the top. And it was the first time, actually, that I'd had like supplements. I think it was creatine, you know, someone said about, you know. And I felt really good. It was the build. And I don't know, did that have a factor or whatever? But it was a ball over the top. Turned and I just felt my hamstring just, you know, ping. And that was it. I was gutted, all that hard work. And I think I was out. Forget, because I had a look, obviously, prior to this interview. I think I've played 37 games that season. So, couldn't have missed that many. Do you know what I mean? Because obviously, 42 games in it back then. So, yeah, there must have been some sub-appearances in that as well. But, yeah, it was just frustrating because, you know, you put all that hard work in. But then the team actually picked up. I remember Mark was on fire. I think they played Bolt and he banged in a worldie. And then I come back into the team. Not sure if it was Birmingham away, my first game back from injury. And then, yeah, obviously I played at Port Vale where we won 2-1, lucky enough to notch. But yeah, I mean, that going back to that game, it was just fantastic. And you the atmosphere at Main Road, you know, I'm so gutted. I went back. When I packed up, there was like an ex-players thing up there. Me and my pal went up there, drove us a couple, and it's knocked down. And I thought, it's criminal. Do you know what I mean? Even like, say like Arsenal at Highbury, he's still got the flats. And I thought, I understand redeveloping and that. But Main Road, you know, I was fortunate enough, as you were, David, you know, to witness it. And these youngsters, if they saw it, it was special, the Kippax and special place.
When you came back from injury, you mentioned kind of coming back in and the team was flying. Is it easier to settle when the team is playing well and there's momentum behind it? Is it easier to just come in and go and just to kind of pick up where you left off?
Yeah, massively. I mean, because I had heard stories like in the season where City sort of got relegated, that, you know, how it could turn. And I was fortunate enough not to witness that. So, yeah, coming into a team that's winning, you know, it does give a massive, you know, the confidence is huge in football, isn't it? And then, we just sort of, you know, just went and joined the lads and, yeah, just sort of kicked on, you know.
Yeah. So you talked about that goal at Port Vale. Do you remember it still?
Yeah, vividly. I mean, just remember it coming over and sort of heading it down and it going in, and the City fans were right behind that goal as well, which was fantastic. And then, I think we won 2-1. I think I've crossed in for... Back then, they used to give own goals for, like, you know, you look at Sean Wright Phillips finished and they've given own goal. You know, it's like... It was actually... it was one at Coventry. I had a look recently and it said, oh, Danny Granville scored. We got beat 4-3. But and then I've looked at it. It was down as an own goal. And there's no way that was an own goal. It was over the line before Richard Hall got a foot to it. But back then, I don't know why, you know, you look at it now and it's, you know, credit to the player. Do you know what I mean? But anyway, so I'm down as 3 goals, but in my mind it's 4.
Well, I was going to say the second one was Boxing Day at West Brom, and that was another. Yeah. I think I remember that game, watching that game on TV, and it was one of those that was a tough game that it was like it kind of gave an indication to what City could achieve that season because it was a tough game. You all fought really hard, and you came out the other side with a win.
Yeah, I mean, I remember that game as well. Because West Brom, you know, they were no mugs themselves, and had Hughes, wasn't it, the forward at the time, who was flying. And a real good side. But yeah, Boxing Day, it was just, I remember we went there and yeah, just a fantastic win. You know, around that time, Christmas time, the games come thick and fast. And, you know, we seemed to pick up a lot of points around that time. And yeah, that was special because I think it was a full house. And again, the City fans were behind that goal when I scored. And I think Sean got the second one, didn't he, Sean Goher? But yeah, we got a 2-0 win away from home around the Christmas period. No, it was fantastic.
Yeah, what was that momentum like in that squad at that time? What was it like playing in a team that would just go to places that should be difficult games and just get through it and win?
Yeah, the thing is, like the expectancy was there with City. You know, every team you went and played, you know, because of the size of the club and, you know, the expectations, It was a full house. There was, you know, and it was a big scalp for other teams to, you know, to beat you. So there was always that bit of pressure, which was brilliant. And then when the team's doing well, naturally, you know, everyone's vying for a position and want to be part of it. And it's a healthy situation to be in, you know. And it was a good squad. That's the thing. It was a healthy squad. So, you know, if someone wasn't pulling their weight, whatever, there was always, you know, replacements. And Joe wasn't, you know, although he kept to you know, regulars, whatever, you know, there was always, you know, ins and outs and comings and goings. Remember Bishop, wasn't he? What a fantastic player he was. Talk about bravery on the ball, you know, to go and pick it up off the back four, he was fantastic, you know, being brave, picking up in areas, dangerous areas where you could lose it. You know, the amount of players, you know, in that team, Tony Grant, who come in, wasn't it? So there was a lot of good players that could fit into, you know. And I think as well, like, say with myself, I was quite adaptable and versatile, so I could do a job in different positions. I think that was the case. You know, you look at it, Mark Kennedy, left wing, left back in his later career. Kevin could go on a left, you know. Versatility is key, and I think that's something that Joe sort of looked at as well. Obviously, there's certain players, Goto, Andy Morris and Spencer Pryor, sort of pinpointed their positions, but, you know, Jeff Whitley could probably do a job, you know, right. But there was that, you know, good sort of chemistry within the team that players could, you know, do jobs in other positions.
Yeah, but then you get to that Friday night against Birmingham at Main Road. You came off the bench in that one to kind of see it out. And yeah. I don't know, when you're kind of coming into a game that is like with 10 minutes left or so, and it's really nervy, it's 1-0, and you're basically being brought on to see it out. What's that like as a defender? Is it like, is there extra pressure there to be able to go on and do your job? Or are you kind of chomping at the bit to get in there and help out?
You are, but then you're an hide into nothing sometimes, because when the player's gone off, whoever, you know, they're winning 1-0, and then you don't want to be a scapegoat who comes on and, oh, you know, so there is that added pressure, you know. Naturally, you don't want to let anyone down, obviously your teammates and coaches, but the fans as well, the supporters. So there is that added pressure. So, yeah, as a defender, you just your job is just to try and see it out with your teammates, and thankfully we did.
Yeah. Do you remember the celebrations on the pitch after? Because the fans rushed on. While promotion wasn't secured, it would have been secured if Ipswich had dropped points the next day. And obviously they then didn't. Was there any concerns that like the reactions were a bit premature?
Yeah, because I remember that must have been the game where the atmosphere was unbelievable. I remember everyone whistling, you know, and it was just like, it was like, you know, never heard nothing like it. And yeah, there is that sort of hold on a minute. Do you know what I mean? It's you know, but teams have been guilty of that over the past. Remember United, we're celebrating too early, but yeah, no, you've got to be careful. And shame it didn't. But then, you know, hats off to the players and the staff. You know, they went and sort of saw it through. You know, although it was a little bit premature. You know, we kept a professional mindset and, yeah, saw it through.
What's it like when, I was going to say, what's it like when you mentioned the whistling there at the end? Obviously, from my point of view, I've always been in the stands when the fans have been whistling, kind of encouraging the full-time whistle. When you're on the pitch and you can hear that, do you get the sense that, oh, it's nearly there, the fans are desperate for this to end?
Massively. So watching my boy now, I always whistle. When I watch him, when it's near the end, then they need to see it. It does, because it just, you know, it just, I don't know, subconsciously, obviously, you know, it's near the end of the game, but I don't know, it might, you know, obviously let the referee. And honestly, I remember that game, it was deafening, the whistles, it was unbelievable atmosphere. And yeah, like I say, you just couldn't hear yourself think. It was that loud. And then for the final whistle to go, I just remember, everyone coming on.
Yeah. So that then leads us to Blackburn. What was the week like ahead of that? What how were Willie and Joe kind of keeping everybody calm and keeping everybody together for that week?
Yeah, do you know what, Willie was fantastic. I mean, up until that point, he had some ways that I'd never experienced in my career. And I've been fortunate enough to play at Cambridge for about six different managers, obviously at Chelsea too, Leeds too. But yeah, as a coach, he was just fantastic. And he was so beyond his years, like, and he a lot of it was mental as well. He'd get you in a room and you'd be like, meditating all the players, and you can obviously, you know, get the giggles and someone would say, but it was just fantastic. He'd have a laugh and then it'd be like serious, you know, keep your feet grounded and just different ways of dealing with it. And there was no way like them two, Joe and Willie, would ever let you feel the pressure. I mean, at that time as well, you know, we used to get like a minibus for home games to go and warm up at a school. And you drive through. On the way there, you wouldn't really see many fans in that. You go and do your warm-up. And I think the mindset behind this was, I heard, you know, previous seasons where players were getting a bit of stick off supporters, whatever, you know, in the warm-up or whatever. And also, you know, it was powerful when it, you know, turning up and then coming out, you know, at 3 o'clock. Sorry, it was 7:45, whenever it was, 3 o'clock. And coming out, and the other players, it must have been really weird for them. Like, where's the other team? Well, we're not. But we just sort of rock up. But turning up as well, coming back from the school, fans were like, you know, it used to give you goosebumps, you know, banging on the van. And you just, although they're trying to protect you, of, you know, it just made you feel, wow, you know, it was so, again, so different, but so powerful.
Yeah, it got you up for it as well. That's the thing, I guess. So then, obviously, Blackburn, the game comes along. You're not in the starting 11. How are you feeling about that?
Yeah, because I played all that season. Then I was a little, so it's a bit sweet, really, isn't it? You want to naturally start, but he changed it at that point. So, like I say, and yeah, you naturally want to be, but it just transpired I wasn't, and he changed it. And then, just waiting to come on. And I remember that Blackburn game. Obviously, you see the City fans on the hill win it over Ewer Park, and you know it was all about City that day, wasn't it? And Blackburn, they were desperate for us not to do it. You know, you could tell, and they, to be honest, we rode our luck that day. You know,
I was going to say, were you feeling a bit kind of helpless on the bench because you're watching them hit the post in the barn? There's nothing you can do about it.
No, that's right. You just like, it's in the hands of the gods that day. But yeah, when I got. Got the time to go on. I remember I had a short haircut at that time. I don't know what made me. Yeah, I remember I come on, I think Paul Dickoff nicked one. He scored and getting hold of him. And yeah, no, it was just, you know, to go and do it there. You know, it was such a relief because, you know, that's what I signed. You know, I wanted naturally to happen. Everyone wanted to happen. And to achieve your goal was just, you know, unbelievable. It is relief because that's how I felt anyway. You know, throughout my career, you know, people say, do you enjoy it? And that you're a pleaser. You're trying to please people. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's when you make people happy and, you know, it's relief because you don't want to let anyone down.
Yeah. Did you manage to get off the pitch at Ewood with your shirt and your shorts and your boots intact? Because I know some players didn't.
Yeah, no, I did. I've got them, actually. I'm quite precious on them, sort of, the bits that you save as... from your career. But no, I remember it was just, there's a picture actually, and I think I'm in the melee of it, and yeah, I think Sean got, he literally had everything taken. I got in there and just went into the changing rooms, but it was just, you know, everyone was just ecstatic. And what support, you know, I remember that far end when it at all the far end, like I say, round the stadium as well on the hill. You know, there's just fans everywhere.
Yeah. You mentioned the Premier League. What was the difference then the next season? What was the step up like? Was it bigger than people realised?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, there is, you know, there's a natural, you know, step up. And I think Joe kept with a lot of the squad, but he sort of drip fed players in as well. Kinchelski's come in, went at one chop. George Weir come in, didn't he? He's, you know, a lot of Alfie Ingerland as well. So I remember Joe, I was with him at Leeds, so I used to share a lift in with Alfie. It's mad actually, because Joanne, my missus, said the other day, like we're watching against Arsenal, this was a couple of seasons back, and Haaland scored, and took his head, she went, oh blimey, look at him. She said, I remember holding him as a baby in the players' lounge. And I went, really? And I looked at it, probably was the case. It's mad to think, you know. But yeah, it was, it's a massive step up, isn't it? And I think, you know, I didn't start off. So I was on the bench at the end of the season and then didn't start off. And then I think they had a decent start and then lost a few. And by that time, I was in the reserves back then, wasn't it? And I said to Joe, I need to be playing, first team. And Jim Whitley was actually at Norwich on loan, so I asked to go to Norwich. I said, I sort of done my own work. They sort of needed a left back. He went, yeah, it's one of my ex-teams, Joe. And I said, he said, yeah, go for a month. And I thought, you know, I've never been one content. I need to be playing. So I went for a month, did all right. They wanted to sign us, actually, which was always a good, you know, good sign. And then I got straight back in the team when I come back. So I think it's the best thing to do, you know, as a player, you need to get out and play competitive football, you know, where it matters, where there's an edge on it. And, I've done that. And then I think I played the remainder of the season. I think we were second from bottom when I sort of come back in the team. And I think we ended up third from bottom. So I think it was quite close. But again, you know, looking back, we had some real, you know, good victory. I remember we beat Sean Goat, scored Newcastle away. I remember drawing 1-0 at home to Liverpool, and we should have won. Man City, we drew 1-1. You know, there was games, a lot of draws. And, you know, you think you only need to, in hindsight, it's an easy thing, but you only need to turn one of them draws into a win, you know. But it's the same for everyone, you know. But it was a shame. And then for Joe to go at the end of the season, you know, it was a shame for him, yeah.
Yeah, what was it like coming off the pitch at Ipswich? Because obviously, having gone down, nobody wants to go down. It is the course of the season that has led to it. But you're still there in the moment when it's happened. What's that like?
Yeah, I think it's just gutting again. You know, for the supporters, like I said before, you want to please. You know, it's the flip side, isn't it? But you know, like you said, you know, at the start of the conversation, what was Joe's sort of mindset? You know, he could have been right, but just, you know, just got promoted, you know, we're just mid-table, whatever. That weren't his mindset, you know, he's gone for it. And maybe if he did just stabilise, and then, you know what I mean? It's like everything happened so quickly. And I thought it was quite harsh for him to go, because, you know, we would have, with the players we had, not saying this, you know, foregone conclusion, but we would have, you'd like to think we'd get promoted again, but obviously Keegan come in, and the rest is history.
Yeah. What was Keegan like to work with? How was he different to Joe?
Nah, totally different. I mean, I remember somewhere I wasn't busy, and that I'd always, you know, we're managers and that I just keep a relationship, and he'd just come in and talk about the weather and, you know, things. He was just, do you know what I mean? He was just different to what, you know, but yeah, no, he was obviously a legend in the game. And his assistant, Arthur Cox, was quality, I must say, because he quite liked me, Arthur, at the start. He went, and Keegan comes to me, he said, you must be a good player. He said, Arthur knows his players because he found me. Like, talking about Keegan, I was like, oh, right. But anyway, he was brilliant, Arthur. What they did, I mean, it was totally different, wasn't it? You know, when you look at that season to go, I think it was Barnsley away, we had Benabia and Al Berkovic playing centre midfield, wing backs, I think I was left wing back, Xavi or someone else, Edu, I don't know, might have been right wing back, but what an attacking team, do you know what I mean? So again, it could go one way or the other. you're either going to tonk someone or you could be on the end of, you know, it was just, don't know if tactically that was Bartlis and got promoted. And you know, when you look at the game now, that sort of tactically managers look at it, do you know what I mean? Back then, I suppose they did, but, you know, you're looking now at our teams, you know, are adaptable. They'll change formation, 4-4-2, you know, go to a 3, you know, wing-backs and whatever, just recognise. You know, I don't know if that was the case so much back then. You know, you sort of stick to a formation, and, yeah, very rarely, you know, would you change.
Yeah.
Because Keegan did, really, didn't he? He stuck with a 5. And listen, it was successful, you know, got promoted, brilliant. So, you know, won the league doing that way.
Email the show through our website, bluemoonpodcast.com.
That was the former City defender, Danny Granville. I'm going to finish with some listener questions. Get in touch on Blue Sky. Just search for Blue Moon Podcast. You can email contact@bluemoonpodcast.com or you can fill in the form on the website as well. We will start. We're going to get progressively less serious with these questions. So we'll start with Matt on the emails, who says, why does nobody ever take into account that while some of the evidence at CAS was time-barred, some of it was not actually proven? Dan, I think this is sparked by, the constant feel that the verdict in the Premier League charges case is coming soon. Mm. And there's been a lot of background pieces written, and there's been a lot of analysis of previous and the background to this case. And I'm seeing it as well as Matt. There's a lot of people out there who basically talk about City winning at CAS on a technicality. but there's two sides to that, isn't there?
You got the job on a technicality. I think people just believe what they want to believe, basically, don't they? I think it's the same with everything nowadays, whether it's like Israel, Palestine, you know, we live in sort of this post-truth, post-fact society where everybody is just completely living in their own little sort of bubbles and you know, not really listening to facts and truth and taking much of it into account and...
Experts.
Know. Yeah, exactly. Which I am not one of by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, the CAS ruling was pretty clear, wasn't it? And, you know, I think with all of this stuff, I think it's generous to City to believe that they are completely innocent of absolutely everything. You know, I think it's reasonable to suspect that perhaps there has been some creative accounting done over the years.
These are just I think the club would say it's not reasonable to expect that, but I think with the information that was leaked and is now in the public domain, I can understand why there would be investigations. Let's put it that way. I think anybody who kind of comes at this from the it's a witch hunt angle is probably misguided.
Yeah.
Because from what has been published, there's like, okay, well, there is grounds to investigate what's going on here.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for making that clearer than I was making there, yeah.
I could just hear the lawyers in the background with the sirens going off, yeah.
This diplomacy required there. Like.
I was breaking ground on a very deep hole there, wasn't I? I think people don't take stuff like that into account, and they just have their own opinions on things that can't be changed no matter what. And that will be the case, you know, if City get a positive outcome from this case with the Premier League, you know, people are going to be going on about how they've paid off the Premier League, you know, all this conspiracy nonsense that's going to be going around. Equally, if it's a negative outcome, I think, you know, City fans are going to really double down on this kind of corruption angle, you know, like we saw with Everton and stuff like that when they were had points deducted last year. So I just don't think that you're going to get a reasonable sort of nuanced, fair debate on social media of these things. And often in you know, the mainstream media, you're not really getting much of a nuanced, fair debate about it. So it's just a very difficult time to be alive for these things, really, to have any kind of like sensible discussion about things, because people just are so biased in their own sort of little worlds, really.
Yeah, in a weird way, Chris. I don't know if you remember a few years ago, the fact that the Premier League were investigating City was subject to, I don't think it was an injunction, but it was both the Premier League and City wanted to keep it quiet. Both of them didn't want it in the public domain, and at the time, all the questions were like, well, if there's an investigation going on, it's in the public interest for it to be public and for people to know about it. And when you hear what's happened in the 2 or 3 years since, and the way, you know, people have just filled in the blanks for themselves, and the way it's talked about now, can kind of get why both sides of this would want it done all in the quiet, because they don't want people filling in the gaps. And you listen to what Dan's just said there, the number of people who have already made up their mind, doesn't matter what happens, does it?
Yeah, to an extent. And of course, both parties have got a brand to protect, haven't they? It's all a lot of negativity floating about. And yeah, people just whipping themselves up into a furore about it. Furore? Tis. I'm so sick of it. Like, I'd almost take relegation now just to get it out of the way. Do I mean that? I'm not sure.
Let's not go mad, yeah.
No. But yeah, just the sooner it comes, the better. I'm absolutely pig sick of it. Like, you can't help but think as well that it's really affected the way the club is run, to the extent that it can't have had a positive impact on the way the first team focus, in terms of, you know, spotlight for the board and the direction of the first team, as this has wound on and on and on and kind of gathered pace and intensity. The team has kind of dropped off this last year as it's culminating. And I don't know, what's he called? Khaldun looks pretty washed out and knackered for someone who normally cuts such a suave, debonair figure. He looks like he's been through the mill a bit. So yeah, for his health, if nothing else, come on, get it to a conclusion.
Yeah, the positive though, Dan, is that if it is a not guilty verdict, then the Premier League will appeal. That'll kick it into next season. If it's a guilty verdict, then City will appeal. That'll kick it into next season. And if it's a guilty verdict, we probably won't find out the punishments until next year anyway.
Fantastic, so, isn't it? What a time to be alive. Yeah. just going back to the original question from Matt as well, about how some of the evidence was not proven. That is something that people can't really grasp with these things as well. That it's like, it's all right having suspicions and allegations of what you think might have happened, but that has to be proven beyond all reasonable doubt. You know, it has to be proven definitively, and that was not done at UEFA. Whatever people's suspicions were about it, you know, like I said, the judgment was clear, and we'll see what the judgment is from this Premier League case. The club have been very confident about it the whole time, perhaps because they know it's going to be really difficult to prove these allegations. We'll see, won't we? But it's
people literally use the word allegation and charge as a stick to beat you with, and it's like, That's not how it works, is it? You can't say, someone said this about you, so that, you know, it's like, well, yeah, people say what they want, let's wait.
There's no smoke without fire, Chris.
Well, smoke machines.
I've literally thought smoke machines. There we are. The Bertieful South now takes us into lighter territory on Blue Sky with this. He says, after listening to last week's show where you talked about goals that left the keeper standing and Nasri's at Wembley after the incredible Yaya Toure goal, how about the best goals you've seen that have been overshadowed by another even better goal in the same game? And Dan, you mentioned one of mine that was on this list earlier in the show. Michael Ball's at Preston was one of mine that I thought of.
Well, I was thinking all eight of Middlesbrough's.
Yeah, Alano with the game stealing goal there. Yeah,
a moral victory for me, that one. Yeah,
yeah, definitely. Higgy, were there any that you thought of?
Well, I'm kind of torn. I struggled with this a bit because I didn't have the comfortable buffer for me to kind of look into it. I don't know if I'm a bit slow on the uptake or what, but the ones that sprang to mind and that came up when I was having a little look at it were more often than not United goals, and I'm torn between kind of highlighting good goals scored by United that were, well, just on that basis, but
overshadowed.
But then the fact that they're overshadowed kind of makes them worth mentioning, because, you know, it's still laughing at United. I don't want to be accused of them living rent-free in my head when they are in fact living in debt just on the outskirts of my city. So there is a difference there. But I'm thinking about the Mark Hughes scored quite a good goal that was absolutely blown out of the water by the other goals in the 5-1, particularly Hinchcliffe's header from that lovely David White cross. There's another one from, Fletcher, in the 6-1, I mean, there were some fantastic City goals in that game. That pass.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. Like, I'm more than happy. Like, if City are going to win the game 5-1, 6-1, I'm more than happy for United to have the best goal of the game.
Well, yeah, I remember that desperate coping mechanism from 1989 when they said, well, we got the best goal of the game. It's like, all right, how many points is that worth, lads? But, yeah, was there any more?
Trying to think that I feel like Rooney scored a great goal at the Etihad when City won 4-1. But
this feels wrong.
Yeah. 13-14, that one.
Yeah.
Anthony even scored a good goal in the 6-3, didn't he? He's an absolute trouser of a man, but managed to bag from distance.
Yeah, we're getting too close to praising United now. So let's move it on to the final question.
Edit that out as well. Just edit me out of
out the entire show. Kevin on the emails got in touch to say, did you see Joe Hart's then versus now video where he had to pick an 11 based on players from City's 2012 title winning team and from the current era? All of his picks were from 2012, apart from Kevin De Bruyne instead of Yaya Toure. So how would a hypothetical game of the 2012 team versus the 2023 treble team go? You don't need to worry about that because I fed that information into an AI, got it to produce a match report, and reporting from the Etihad Stadium for this hypothetical game for the Blue Moon podcast, we've got Conor McNamara.
The 2012 side started with intent. Joe Hart's early save from a curling Kevin De Bruyne effort set the tone. While Yaya Toure's thunderous presence in midfield hinted at the physicality that defined their title run-in. It was Toure who broke the deadlock in the 18th minute, bulldozing past Ruben Diaz before rifling a shot low past Edison into the corner. The 2023 team, however, responded with the slick, relentless style that swept Europe aside. De Bruyne pulling the strings, found Haaland with a pinpoint through ball in the 29th minute, and the Norwegian made no mistake, slotting past Hart to level up at 1-1. Just before half-time, Haaland struck again. This time he headed in a whipped João Cancelo cross to give the 2023 side the lead. The treble winner's clinical edge was starting to show. The 2012 team roared back after the break, though, fueled by the never-say-die spirit that defined their dramatic title win. David Silva danced through the 2023 defence in the 54th minute, laying it off to Carlos Tevez, whose fierce strike cannoned off the bar. Sergio Aguero pounced on the rebound to equalise for 2-2. Yet the 2023 side's tactical nous proved decisive. Rodri restored their lead in the 67th minute, rising above company to head in a De Bruyne corner. In the closing stages, the 2012 defence held firm against a relentless wave of attack, and Haaland was only denied a hat-trick by Hart's sprawling save in the 80th minute. Sami Nasri nearly snatched a late equaliser, but his curling shot skimmed past Edison's post, and 3-2 it finished.
There we go. That's how the game would go. Thank you very much to Connor for doing that for us. I messaged him really late last night and said, I've had this idea, will you do it? And he said yes, so fair play to him. Dan, happy with that outcome?
I'm happy with where my licence fee money's gone on that, actually.
Hey, it's extracurricular. He wasn't doing it during work time, was he?
Fair enough. Yeah, thank you, Connor. That was fantastic. I think that's about right, actually. Yeah, 3-2 win for the treble team. I think they were, you know, they were probably slightly edge of game like that. Probably a better coached team than Mancini's team for all of Mancini's brilliance. And I love the guy. I think the team was very much built on vibes, wasn't it, really? More than Pep's sort of meticulous passing metronome that we've become accustomed to over the years. But in a one-off game, I think City's 2012 team would give anyone a game as well. So, yeah, I think it was about right.
Yeah, it's a good result for the 2023 team, that, Higgy, because the 2012 team only dropped 2 points at home all season.
Well, that's what wins you trebles. That kind of, I think the tactical nous does come into it there, because it was a bit of a beginning. You know, it was a bit of an origin story for him, wasn't it, in 2012. So, as we proved in the Champions League around that sort of time, we didn't quite have the nous that the treble team had. So, yeah, I think that reflects well on what would have happened.
Yeah, fair
result. Fantastic to hear the commentary as well.
Yeah, fair result. Kevin De Bruyne was man of the match, by the way. That's the AI told me that as well. That's it for today's Blue Moon podcast. Thank you very much to my guests for this one. Dan Burke.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And Chris Higginbottom.
Cheers for having me. Nice one.
There's a clip of this week's Nostalgia episode coming up shortly. That was City fan Cheech picking out his five special City matches in the games that made me. The full thing is available on our Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. We'll be back next week after the games with Bournemouth and Leicester. See you then.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
There's something about Phil Foden, a Stockport lad, scoring a hat-trick for City against United. Like, do you know what I mean? It's like all the Bertian blocks are there, aren't they?
Absolutely, yeah, it does. It ticks every box. And that, going back to kind of areas of the stadium and stuff like that. So I'm bottom of the south stand, right next to the away fans, and it's so much fun on days like that. It really is. Just seeing headlocks everywhere. Doesn't get better than that. All the trophies in the world are amazing, but if you could kind of bottle up the feeling in that particular moment, I don't think it gets much better than that.
What would the young Cheech that was being told by his dad to go and like go into the playground, keep his head held high because they just lost the derby, what would he make of everything that's happened and that, like, go into that derby and seeing City dismantle United and win 6-3?
Well, he'd be absolutely astonished. It's the sort of stuff that I used to daydream about. I kind of expected it would happen, but that it would be me rather than Abu Dhabi that power shift in Manchester. But no, you wouldn't believe it. You'd bite someone's arm for it. And maybe someone has.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. And join us again next time for another episode.